To begin our third and final panel. This is perhaps the most important one, or most interesting one of all. It deals with the with penalties. Ultimately, at the end of the day, it all comes down to money. No matter how big the file, ultimately it comes down to a check being written, either from the taxpayer to the U.S. Treasury, or hopefully, and every now and then, from the U.S. Treasury to the taxpayer. But that's how these things ultimately get resolved. And the purpose of this panel is to deal generally with penalties, civil penalties, and criminal penalties, ways in which penalties can be mitigated, decisions of whether or not we should follow the structure of the voluntary disclosure program of the 20% and the occasional and perhaps mythical 5%, or at least it's in the books, or whether people should opt out. If people opt out, are people likely to be better off or worse off? Do the clients have stomach for the ambiguities and dangers involved in opting out? These are some of the matters that we're going to be discussing now.
Hello, I am Tim Weeks. I'm an associate at M. Robinson & Company, and I know we've talked a lot about penalties today. We've touched on a whole bunch of things. Hopefully this part of the presentation will coalesce everything. I'm just going to go over the general framework of, well, first civil penalties, and then civil penalties and non-willful, and then we're going to talk about criminal penalties. And I would ask the panelists to just jump in wherever they feel appropriate. Now, to start off, there's actually four types of penalties for FBAR violations. The first is negligence, pattern of negligence, non-willful, and willful violations. CPAs, I'm sure, deal with individuals as well as businesses. I'm going to note that the penalties for negligence and pattern of negligence only apply to businesses. They don't apply to individuals. We're going to focus on individual taxpayers, so really the central focus of the penalty framework that we're going to discuss talks about whether a violation is willful or not. As Matthew noted before, penalties apply to each account for each account holder or anyone with signature authority over the account, and for each year that there is a violation. And also I should note, as has been noted previously, that you only need to file an FBAR if the amount in the account is greater than $10,000 for the year. So here we have willful, and again, this is really the central standard when it comes to individual taxpayers. The question of willfulness is whether the taxpayer voluntarily and intentionally violated a known legal duty. That's been defined or illustrated in the code, in the Internal Revenue Manual, as whether the taxpayer knew of the FBAR reporting requirement and made a conscious choice not to comply. In the civil context, the government has to prove willfulness by clear and convincing evidence, which means that it's substantially more likely than not that the taxpayer knew he had to file the FBAR, but he consciously chose not to. When we talk about the criminal aspect of willfulness, it's obviously a conviction for an FBAR violation under the Bank Secrecy Act requires beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, willfulness really is an important thing, because when we talk about the penalties that come later, we're talking about either a $10,000 violation or a 50% violation of the amount in the account, which is could be astronomical. There was a recent case that came down, this Eastern District of Virginia, September 1st, 2010. It specifically dealt with the willfulness in the FBAR issue. This one, the government asserted that the taxpayer Williams, he willfully did not file his FBAR and in this case, he, on his Schedule B, Part 3, he actually checked no that he had no foreign accounts, even though 8 years prior he set up about $7 million in a Swiss account. Yeah, whoops. And he actually did file FBARs for a couple of years, and then in 2000 he did not. It was actually held for the taxpayer that it was not willful, even though he said that he did not, he checked no that he did not have a foreign account. He knew at that time that both the Swiss authorities and the U.S. authorities knew of the existence of the account. So even though he checked no, the court held that he didn't have any intent to conceal, because his intent already knew that there's nothing to conceal because the government already knew about it. It's sort of circular logic, but it worked out in favor of the taxpayer.
Can I just comment on the Williams case?
Sure, yeah.
Williams case is a little unusual in that, one, Williams had been convicted of a tax crime. I think it was a tax evasion. And the issue was whether he was required to file an FBAR in 2 years, where I think the accounts had actually been frozen.
Mm-hmm.
And the IRS assessed a willfulness penalty against him, and ultimately ended up in court. And it's unusual for another reason, too, because it highlights the procedural differences between a Title 31 penalty and a Title 26 penalty. The IRS can assess an FBAR penalty under Title 31, but the tax court does not have jurisdiction over the FBAR penalty. So unlike, say, an income tax assessment where somebody gets a 90-day letter and they can petition the tax court for review, you can't do that with an FBAR penalty. And what happened in Williams is the IRS assessed the penalty and then went into federal district court to reduce the penalty to a judgment. And at that point, the taxpayer contested the penalty. So it's a little unusual. The normal collection mechanisms that are available to the IRS are not available in the FBAR context.
I would suggest it is a little unusual in that it may not be the most representative case, although this is recent and it's pretty much the only one that deals specifically with this issue. But I think if this is going to be contested, there's going to be need to be a lot more clarification from the courts on exactly what willfulness is.
Sorry, I'm going to follow up on that point as well. For those of you who are not keeping up on some of the future reporting requirements, it looks like pretty much all the information that's going on the FBAR, but of course not in the same format, is going to be required on regular tax returns, I think from 2011, and I think it's for if the client has $50,000 or more in foreign accounts. So in the future, we could be facing FBARs as well as tax return penalties and issues. So the IRS seems to be trying to merge the two. I think part of it has to do with the mismatch in the penalty structure and ability to collect. But the reporting requirements are certainly not getting easier.
Excuse me.
I'm sorry. Is that factor? Is it a new information, an additional informational return versus return of our additional reporting requirements on the Form 1040?
My understanding, it's additional reporting requirements on the Form 1040. There's some preliminary guidance, comment, etc. that's out there. Since I don't have to file returns myself, I haven't kept up too much because it's, as I said, I think it's starting from 2011 tax returns, but...
I think later, perhaps later on.
I read the same material that you read, and I can confirm that that's my impression also. It was part of fact that reporting requirement will be instituted. We're awaiting guidance from the IRS as to how to do that reporting.
Yeah.
Going back to non-willful FBAR violations, it's important to point out that there was no penalties for non-willful violations before October 23rd, 2004. So, especially within the voluntary disclosure program, which covers 2003 to 2008, 03 zero penalty, since the FBAR was due June 30th, that would be 04 is out, and then therefore, for non-willful penalties within the voluntary disclosure program, actually within the years covered by the voluntary disclosure program, I should say, it's only 05, 06, 07, and 08. So that could, we're going to see later, it sort of may tilt the balance in opting out of the program if you can prove non-willfulness. For non-willful violations after October 22nd, 2004, the maximum penalty is $10,000, as we talked about before. Reasonable cause. This is Title 31, Section 5321A5. No penalty is imposed if there was reasonable cause and the amount and the FBAR was properly reported. Under the first prong of the reasonable cause exception, and this is according to the Internal Revenue Manual, the taxpayer must have exercised ordinary business care and prudence in determining their tax obligations, but nevertheless failed to comply. Under the second prong, you file the FBARs. It's sort of unclear how this is described in the Internal Revenue Manual. But this is what it says. The examiner must receive the delinquent FBARs from the non-filer in order to avoid the application of the non-willfulness penalty. So if you can meet that, the reasonable cause exception, and file the delinquent FBARs, no penalty will be imposed. Again, talking about willful violations, we have that October 23rd, 2004 demarcation, where the penalty for a willful violation before the time is $25,000 or the amount in the account, which as long as it doesn't exceed $100,000. And here's the big one, the after October 22nd, 2004, willful greater of $100,000 or 50% in the account. No reasonable cause exception for a willful FBAR violation. Now, we talked about before how, you know, if you either opt out or, well, no, if you opt out, then the impression is in the real world that the IRS is going to throw the book at you and that they're going to go straight for the 50% or the $100,000 and you'll be in trouble. That's not how it's supposed to be. According to all the stuff I'm going to talk about now is based on the Internal Revenue Manual, which it shows the discretion that they have in actually have imposing a penalty less than the 50% in many, many circumstances. In fact, well, we'll see about it later. Penalty mitigation, you have to meet four threshold conditions, and that will allow you to be subject to less than the maximum per violation. Again, that's the Internal Revenue Manual. The four threshold conditions are the taxpayer has no history of any past FBAR violations. The money was not from an illegal source. The taxpayer cooperated during the examination. No civil fraud penalties were sustained for the year in question. And if you meet those, you will be possibly able to mitigate any penalties imposed. This can get kind of boring, but I wanted to give it to you because it sort of outlines the various, how the penalties are mitigated. So if you have less than $50,000 in the account, if you could be, it's only $500 per, a penalty of $500. If you have $50,000 to $250,000 account, you have 5,000 or 10%. Greater than $250,000, and this is willful again, the maximum is $10,000, as we talked about before. Here's willful. I'm not going to read all this stuff. but again, you see that from level 1 to level 4, we have level 4 is the maximum, essentially no mitigation applies, but if based on the account balances, you could qualify for level 3, level 2, or level 1. Yes?
Is that for normal?
This is for willful. Did I say? Oh, yeah, willful. Sorry if I misspoke. Actually, willful prior to October 23rd, 2004, and these are after October 23rd, 2004, which again, you have the maximum here, $100,000 or 50%, all the way up or all the way down to $1,000, the greater of $1,000 or 5% of the amount in the account. So this is what the Internal Revenue Manual says, even though it may not be practiced on the street. The actual amount of the penalty is left to the discretion of the taxpayer, or is of the IRS examiner.
That'd be good.
Yeah. Left to the IRS examiner. And according to them, examiners should consider whether the issuance of a warning letter and the securing of delinquent FBARs rather than the assertion of the penalty will achieve the desired result of improving compliance in the future. That is the goal of the FBAR penalties, is to ensure compliance in the future and deter any other violators. And again, according to the Internal Revenue Manual, the assertion of separate penalties for multiple violations with respect to a single FBAR should only be considered in the most egregious cases. I added the underline because I think that's important. This is mainly where you have two account holders and there's an issue with that. They only in the most egregious cases should they throw the book at both taxpayers for failing to file the FBAR. Factors to consider in discretion, again, compliance, whether compliance will be achieved by a warning letter instead of a monetary fine, whether the person has been previously issued a warning letter. If in that case, you're probably not going to be awarded much discretion because obviously it didn't work. The amount involved and the cooperation of the taxpayer during the during the examination. And as was previously noted, we talked about a couple of these. If you're not in the voluntary disclosure program, all the other penalties apply as well. So you have failure to file, failure to pay, accuracy penalties, and we talked about the Form 3520, the receipt of foreign trust, gifts from foreign trusts issue. All right, here we go. Here's the package deal. And again, I know I'm going over some stuff we already talked about, but hopefully it puts it into a nice structure. This is the package deal. According to the IRS, you don't have any say on it. You're in the program, and this is what you will be subject to, or you're not in the program, in which case all the other stuff may apply. And as Bill has noted, they're going to throw the book at you. If you're in the voluntary disclosure program, you have to file and amend all returns, or returns in FBARs. You pay taxes, you pay interest, a 20% accuracy slash delinquency penalty, and you have the offshore account penalty, which is 20% of the maximum account balance over the period of the voluntary disclosure. I think it's important to note, well, first, that this 20% is in lieu of all these others that may apply. So, yes?
Talk about the 20%, maybe you're going to get to it, but one of the frequently asked questions that's in your materials says that the 20%, that the actual liability should be the lesser of the various penalties that would have been assessed for the 20%. Now, this may be honored more in the breach than in the real world, because I suspect that most agents are simply going to say 20%, don't bother me, I'm stressed out, I've got more cases than I can handle, etc. But I think it's something that that practitioners should want to consider, at least the official position, according to yesterday's questions and frequently asked questions, it's on the website, is that the 20% is the maximum, and it can be reduced if the other penalties would be less than the 20%. Now, the IRS will probably take the position that they want that the maximum is should be 50% or more, but it's something to talk about. And I think that everybody who represents a client should be talking about these things, about getting the IRS, if possible, to mitigate.
Thank you. Yes?
Sorry, I wanted to add a little information from before. Form 8938, that's going to be the statement of foreign financial assets that's going to be going with the 1040 in the future. And it says here, attached to your tax return, if you own specified foreign financial assets having an aggregate value of more than $50,000. So I think 8938 will be required from 2011.
The last point I wanted to make on this deal, this package deal, is that in the case of a foreign account that's owned by two people or more, only one of these 20% offshore account penalties is going to apply to that account. So a lot of times, I mean, other penalties each taxpayer will be subject to, this only applies to one account, despite the fact that there are multiple account owners. And here again is the mythical 5%. We have the 20% reduced to 5% if taxpayer did not cause or open any accounts to be opened or entities formed, no activity in the account, which, I mean, no deposits, withdrawals, and other people have suggested even a CD rolling over, interest accruing, may be considered activity, which would prevent the yes.
Is it 20%, is it applied every year, or is it just applied?
No, I'm sorry, I should have said that. It's just once. It's the highest year with the highest balance and 20% of that. In the last, all applicable U.S. taxes have been paid on the funds in the accounts, which, I mean, really, it is mythical, because if you're not disclosing that, you're most likely not paying taxes on it either. One person in a law review noted that reduction is essentially applies to an inherited account that has never been accessed by the person who received it. So I wish people luck in going to 5%.
Tim?
Yes.
One other point. Your last bullet says all applicable U.S. taxes have been paid on the funds.
Yes.
The frequently asked questions that you have in your materials basically says that if you've reported the income and if you've paid the tax, then there will be no FBAR penalties. So basically, we're dealing with situations where if you're in the program, it means that you haven't reported all of the tax. We're talking about the income tax purposes. You haven't reported all of the income. You haven't paid all of the tax. And so if item number three is a bullet, basically the 5% becomes mythical.
Absolutely.
One other point, as you're talking about penalties and maximum values, for those of you who don't follow this every day or each year, the dollar is depreciated dramatically in value against many foreign currencies. So while the clients might feel like, oh geez, the account hasn't done very much in euros or Swiss francs or whatever, the dollar value may actually have increased somewhat dramatically, as our government has clearly tried to debase the value of the dollar to get us out of the recession. So your choice of exchange rate and exchange rate methodology can have a pretty big impact on calculating these penalties. IRS recommends the site Oanda.com for quote official exchange rates.
Can you tell us what that is again?
Oanda, OANDA.com. They have historical exchange rates going back a significant amount of time on a daily basis. It's very easy to get average rates over a given time period for multiple currencies. But I've seen it in IRS publications. They specifically recommend this site.
Sorry, I'm just writing it down. This is, talk about criminal penalties. I'm gonna hold off and let Bill talk about that because he's more experienced in that. I am gonna talk about should someone opt out. And I put together this little chart that I think is helpful. If the taxpayer can rebut the claim that he acted willfully and therefore is not subject to either this very severe civil or criminal penalties, I think there's clear pecuniary advantages to withdrawing from the program. Here's my little chart, which somehow got messed up in the conversion. Anyway, I apologize for that. On the top of the account balances, I've assumed 12% growth each year. So we start out with $2 million, we end up with $4 million. In the end, actually, so Sorry, this is tough to read.
Who's your investment manager that got you 12% during that period?
That's a good question. I did a little research.
Probably with an M.
I did a little research, and you know, maybe you could speak better to rates of return over those years, but.
Well, the S&P did about zero in the last 10 years, except for dividends, so.
Okay, well, then forgive my analysis.
That's okay.
So in the end here, with income tax, interest, 25% failure to file, 25% failure to pay, we have $4,000 for a non-willful penalty of $10,000 each year, because again, for 03 and 04, there was no non-willful penalty. Total non-VDP liability, sorry, you can't really see in there, $1.72 million. Okay, so that's, and then we have, this one looks nice. Then we have, within the voluntary disclosure program, it's a lot cleaner, as you saw before. You pay the income tax, the interest, the 20% accuracy penalty. Here's the kicker, though. You're paying $800,000 for the maximum amount of account, which was, you know, $4 million times 0.2, $800,000. Total voluntary disclosure program liability is $2.2 million. So in the end, you have nearly, you're paying $500,000 more in the program than not in the program. Yes?
I have a question for the rest of the panel. If the client has been paying or having withheld foreign taxes on income earned in these accounts, what effect do you think that may have in terms of the penalty amounts or just general treatment from the IRS?
Would you repeat that again?
Yeah. The question is, you know, there are a lot of people out there who are dual nationals. They are filing tax returns in other countries. And my question is, if the client has been paying taxes to a foreign jurisdiction, either through automatic withholding and or filing a tax return, what effect does the panel think that will have as far as how the IRS will treat? We haven't talked much about treaties today, but there's a lot of tax treaties out there, and I'm just wondering what you guys think. Will it enhance the case at all, or lower the penalties if they can be shown that in fact they've been paying taxes just to a different jurisdiction?
In my view, it negates willfulness. As Tim mentioned, the willfulness standard is a voluntary, intentional violation of a known legal duty. That language actually comes from a United States Supreme Court case, U.S. v. Cheek. It was a criminal tax case, and it set the standard for the intent requirement in a criminal tax case. The IRS applies the same standard to the willfulness penalty for an FBAR. Although the burden of proof for the FBAR penalty is less than it is in a criminal case. Very rarely will you have direct evidence of a person's willfulness, you know, direct evidence being a conversation with someone where the taxpayer says, oh, I know I'm supposed to file the FBAR, but I'm not going to do it. The IRS will typically seek to prove willfulness by circumstantial evidence, and that evidence may be shell corporations or other conduct, the intent of which is to conceal the income of the assets. In the case that you bring up, Jonathan, where the taxpayer is paying the tax but just to a different jurisdiction, in my view, that certainly negates any willfulness on the part of the taxpayer, and hopefully the IRS would take the same view.
Okay. So,
if I can add to Bill's remarks, on several different occasions in the frequently asked questions, the IRS says again, and then a third time, we're only interested in penalties where the tax was not reported and paid. Well, in this particular case, we have a technical failure to report. But as a practical matter, the tax may well have been paid because the maximum tax in the United States for the past few years has been 35%. the maximum tax rate in many European countries exceeds 35%, which means that the foreign tax credit, which is the lesser of the U.S. tax or the foreign tax, will negate a United States tax. So we find ourselves in a situation where there is technical non-compliance, but as a practical matter, there has been compliance. And so I think that for both reasons, I think a strong case ought to be made for no penalty in this situation. And if this case were in my office, I would dig in my heels hard, consistent with the amount involved. If the amount involved is $12,000, I'm not going to dig in my heels very hard because you can't spend more than the case is worth. But if we're talking about $1.2 million, you know, just move a couple of zeros over, move the decimal point, you betcha, we'd fight that one real hard.
I wanted to make a comment about staying in the voluntary disclosure program versus pulling out, withdrawing from the program. I think it's important. I mean, I think this financial analysis is really important to see where a client would stand in the program and outside the program from a financial standpoint. But I think it's also very important to assess the other costs of pulling out of the voluntary disclosure program that can't easily be quantified. For all its flaws, voluntary disclosure program does come with a certain amount of peace of mind for clients that, if they cooperate and provide all this information and are forthright, that they're not going to be criminally prosecuted or that the IRS won't recommend criminal prosecution in that case. Withdrawing from the voluntary disclosure program, all bets are off. You could be subject to criminal prosecution. My understanding is you're going to be subjected to a full-blown audit. And those are all considerations that should be factored in addition to this, the $500,000 savings. There could be other, an audit can come with its own legal costs and a lot of emotional turmoil potentially for the client. So I think that should also be.
I totally agree. It does not include litigation costs or peace of mind or everything else that could come with a full-blown audit, which the IRS will do. But if the numbers are high enough, it should be something to be considered. And I think also, as practitioners, even if the client is completely against opting out of the voluntary disclosure program and they want just slap me with a 20% penalty, I think they have to know the difference. I think they have to make an informed decision to get you off the hook so that 5 years later, when the kids realize that mom gave up $5 million off the bat just because she wanted to sleep well at night, I think as practitioners, they have to cover themselves as well.
And by covering themselves, this means, as a practical matter, this is a take-home takeaway with you. Get it in writing. This is what it is with the program. This is what it is outside of the program. You don't want to opt out, that's fine. But this is a choice that you've made and that you've been advised. Please sign here that you receive this information. It's no different than when somebody's going in for an operation, and the doctor says these are the pluses and minuses of the operation. These are the potential benefits. These are the potential dangers. Sign here. The patient always signs. In this particular case, you have to be just like the doctor. You get the patient, in this case your client, to sign here. We insist on it in our office. I think it's a takeaway.
Well, if you sit here and make a decision that I'm going to opt out because of this, does that make you willful?
No.
No.
No. In other words, Ron, in a situation
not
like...
Not you, I mean the client. You're making a willful decision.
No.
Can I address this? And this is going to make everyone in this room feel uncomfortable.
Great.
In a criminal tax case, good faith reliance on advice of a practitioner is a complete defense. Which oftentimes, puts a practitioner in a bad position if there's a criminal case, because The client will say, I relied on tax advice that was given by my CPA or attorney, and I didn't know any better. And then you get into issues on, well, what was disclosed to the CPA or attorney? But and that applies, I would think, although I haven't seen this in practice, that applies to the FBAR penalty as well. So if you're giving advice to your clients on whether to file an FBAR and what to report and what not to report, you might expect the client to say, this is what my accountant told me to do. Opting out of the program based on advice that's given by a practitioner is not evidence of willfulness in my view. If your client lies to you about an account and doesn't disclose it to you, that is evidence of willfulness. The other point I want to make is when you're thinking about whether to opt out of the program, because an FBAR penalty is a Title 31 penalty, as I mentioned earlier, you can't go to tax court to contest an FBAR penalty. Tax court, the Williams case stands for the proposition that tax court doesn't have jurisdiction, statutory jurisdiction to decide that. So I am not aware of any instance where you can go to an appeals officer and argue about the FBAR penalty. I think what happens in practice is it gets assessed, and then the IRS is left to reduce it to judgment, which they may or may not do. I think at the time the IRS makes the determination as to whether to reduce the penalty to judgment, it's at that point our IRS Chief Counsel's Office and the Department of Justice gets involved and looks at the case and decides, is this something we want to pursue? So I think the procedural protections that are in place normally when you're dealing with the IRS are not there for the FBAR penalty because of the unique nature.
Bill, one of the requirements for being in the voluntary disclosure program is full cooperation. If the taxpayer has the money to pay and chooses not to pay, isn't that evidence of lack of full cooperation, which would allow the IRS to bounce the taxpayer out of this program?
I think theory, yes, but I think the voluntary disclosure program is designed to get an assessment on the books. So I'm not sure, and I'm not aware of any case where somebody has been bounced for the program because they're not dealing with collections. So I think as a practical matter, it's the assessment that's key for the voluntary disclosure program.
Bill, I have another question for you. A few people in the audience, as well as my own experience, there's a number of us who are working with people who live overseas, either as dual nationals or as Americans. Now, as a practical matter, if the accounts are overseas in a foreign jurisdiction in a foreign bank, and someone goes through voluntary disclosure, and or silent disclosure for that matter, penalties are assessed, and then all the issues that we talk about, like full-blown audits, etc., having to pay penalties or not, would there be any sort of different advice or practical matters as to what recourse the IRS would have with a client overseas?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think from a criminal perspective, there's a question as to whether the IRS can extradite the person. And when you make an extradition request to, say, Switzerland, you would submit the charges to Switzerland, and Swiss authorities would do an analysis as to whether the crimes charged are a violation of Swiss law. It tends to be a long and drawn out process. And for that reason, they don't tend to prosecute people in those type of circumstances.
And the Swiss won't extradite Swiss citizens, to the best of my knowledge,
right,
even if they're dual national.
Right. So that's one factor. The other question, and I haven't seen this, is whether the government is going to actually be able to get access to the money that is sitting in these UBS accounts. I've seen it in the context of plea deals where there's money overseas, and as part of the plea, the defendant agrees to repatriate the money. Mm-hmm. But I think it's an open question as to whether the IRS can actually get money out of UBS. And that will be interesting to see how that plays out.
Well, yeah, some of the attorneys I had spoken to on this matter said, you know, as a final matter, if there's disagreement, you know, don't pay. Right. And the, I mean, not an area that I'm getting into advising on, but it seems that for people who have no intention of returning to the U.S. and have gotten caught up in something that in many cases they didn't intend to get caught up in, they're not trying to break U.S. rules and are complying locally, the borders in this case can perhaps provide some additional protection.
Right. My prediction is that at some point someone in the IRS is going to get the idea of to try to repatriate some of these funds, and we'll see how that goes. But I'm not aware that it's happened, you know, at least in the civil context.
I turn it over to you, Bill, if you want to talk about criminal penalties.
Sure. Essentially, there are a couple different statutes that the IRS and the Department of Justice use to prosecute tax crimes and FBAR crimes. There's a typical tax evasion statute, which is a five-year felony, maximum penalties up to 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. There's a false return statute, which has a maximum penalty of up to 3 years in prison. There's a Klein conspiracy statute, which is a conspiracy to impede and impair the IRS. And there's also an FBAR statute, which is it makes it a felony to fail to file an FBAR. All of these statutes are driven by one thing, and the amount of time somebody will ultimately end up spending in jail is driven by one thing, and that's the amount of tax that's evaded. Under the United States sentencing guidelines, there are ranges, and if you evade between $200,000 and $400,000 in tax, you're at a certain level. If you plead guilty, you get to reduce that level by two or three levels. And ultimately, there's a chart, and the judge looks at the chart and says, okay, the chart tells me I should sentence you to 12 to 18 months imprisonment, and hopefully your lawyer can get up and say, well, he's a good guy, you know, he's done all these good things in his life, he's got three kids, he didn't really mean it, and the judge will give him probation. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. But what really is critical is the amount of the tax that's involved, that was evaded. And in the materials, there are actually two criminal informations where two taxpayers in Boston were charged recently by criminal information, and they were charged with failing to file an FBAR. And these are two, I would say, from the fact pattern described in the information, these are two typical cases. You had two taxpayers that had, one had a British Virgin Islands corporation and one had a Panamanian corporation that they set up through UBS. And they didn't report the income that was generated from those accounts, and they didn't disclose the accounts by checking the box on Schedule B, and they never filed an FBAR. So these are the typical type tax evasion cases you see. The fact that somebody has a Panamanian corporation and doesn't disclose it is evidence of willfulness. What is striking to me about these cases is the tax loss in each of the cases is relatively low. In the first case, the Rudolph case, the tax loss is $25,000. And in the second case, it's about $70,000. And I would have to guess, based on the fact that this is a criminal information versus an indictment, that the taxpayers are cooperating with the government, which would further reduce the sentence. And based on the numbers, you know, these would probably be probation cases where the taxpayer would not go to jail. Most of the UBS clients that have been prosecuted have not been sentenced to prison. There was one person in New York who got a year and a day And like these taxpayers, he had offshore accounts, and there was substantial amounts of money going through them, unlike these taxpayers. But I think what we're seeing in the, on the criminal side, the trend is, you know, probation for the taxpayers, although you are a convicted felon after pleading guilty to these charges, which carries with it some of its own collateral consequences. I had some statistics that Jonathan gave me, and just in terms of how often pure FBAR cases like these are filed. In 2008, there were six nationwide. In 2007, there were six. 2006, there were 12. 2005, there were 18. In 2004, there were 17. So prior to UBS, this was not something that the IRS focused on. And my guess would be that the cases that did get filed, that was a plea deal where somebody didn't want to plead guilty to tax evasion and thought the FBAR was less onerous. So you will see cases. My guess is that the Department of Justice is probably going after more UBS employees. Whether they'll be able to get them is anybody's guess. But typically they focus more on the advisors than they do the taxpayers. And again, the key to a criminal tax case normally is willfulness and what evidence the IRS can develop to show that the person intentionally violated a known legal duty. They did it on purpose and it wasn't a mistake.
Can I make a comment?
Sure.
Remember earlier we were talking about different types of taxpayers. We talked about the technical violator who reported the tax but didn't and paid the tax but didn't file the FBAR. And then we talked about the honest innocent, the person who inherited the bank account. I want to tell you about a situation that I read about in the newspaper about 6 months ago. A physician in Virginia inherited a bank account. The parents hadn't reported the income from the bank account, and FBARs hadn't been filed. The physician was contacted by the parent's attorney in Geneva, and the attorney advised the physician that the best thing for him to do was to repatriate the money. And so he went to Switzerland, he got the money in cash, brought it to the United States, and deposited it in his bank account. Well, of course, once you make a deposit of over $10,000 in a bank account, there's a particular snitch form that has to be filed. And if you file a snitch form, they got you. If you don't file a snitch form, the bank will report you. So he got reported. Well, the government said that by coming to the United States with all this money, this was a willful violation of the rules. And because of this willfulness, I believe he actually received a prison sentence. Certainly, as a physician, he probably lost his license because practicing medicine is a privilege. And one of the things that you have to do if you're going to practice medicine is you can't be in material violation of the rules. And as a convicted felon, he may have lost his license to practice medicine. He certainly lost his good name. He may have lost his reputation. So the point that I'm trying to make is that, well, in these particular situations that Bill brought up, we had a businessman who knowingly and intentionally set up a Panamanian corporation or a British Virgin Islands corporation with the intent to evade the law. These people we suspect they're probably going to get probation. Then we have the honest innocent who comes into the United States on the advice of Swiss counsel. And Johnson, I'm not saying anything bad about Swiss nationals. There can be bad apples even in Switzerland. But he comes into the United States on the advice of Swiss counsel. He takes action. The father died. The mother asks the physician to go along. He follows his mama's advice. And this guy goes to jail. So it just shows how careful you have to be in situations like this.
Yeah.
Thank you.
With respect to that, there are certainly a number of advisors in just about every jurisdiction where there's any significant amounts of money who will help people to try and break the law. And one thing that you may consider, I mean, they will advise this Bradley Birkenfeld case, you know, there's bringing diamonds in toothpaste tubes and things like that. Now, if clients are following the bad advice of other advisors, for example, the physician you mentioned was, I think I'm familiar with the case, he did it over a series of trips and deposited regular amounts over a period of time. So I'm just wondering if you're defending a client who's taking the bad advice of another advisor, is that a reasonable defense for
their
actions?
Well, as I mentioned, good faith reliance is a defense. If somebody's telling you to bring diamonds and toothpaste tubes, you know, or somebody's telling you to, you know, don't bring the money you all back at once and deposit it in amounts under $10,000.
Right,
you're structuring, and you know, I'm not sure that's good faith reliance. So, but you know, it's what a, you know, the standard is, what would a reasonable person do with this advice?
Take a check.
That's probably good advice. Yeah. Send the attorney over to bring the money back.
Mail me a check.
Incidentally, at the banks in Switzerland for money laundering, one of the cases that we study over there, small amounts in cash, it could be small amounts, $100 at a time being deposited into an account is enough for them to have to file one of these disclosure reports. So if people show up at the post office on a regular basis, 100 francs, 200 franc deposits in small notes, that's actually apparently a sign of drug dealing. And so it doesn't, that $10,000 limit is pretty mythical. If there's just patterns of deposits, doesn't matter the amounts, they're going to pick them up. So clients who think that by transferring $9,000 a month or things like that, that all of a sudden they're avoiding the radar screen, that's a myth.
And I would just add to that, when the IRS does criminal cases, there's ways that they prove the unreported income or overreported expenses. And one of the ways they do it is through the bank deposits method of proof, where they look for regular deposits. Doesn't have to be 10,000 or 9,000. It's regular deposits, and they can establish a likely source of the income. You know, that's how they prove cases.
Yeah, and as far as the foreign bank reporting forms, there's lots of methods now. You know, you can have a card, essentially like a debit card, with amounts on it in foreign currency. From what I'm seeing, even those need to be reported on the form. So if your in-laws overseas, happy birthday, here's a 5,000 euro gift on a card, that's considered a foreign bank account as well. So, you know, when you're speaking with clients, go to extremes to try and show them what are taxable type transactions or reportable events, and they're more than they may imagine.
I have a question for the group. How many people in the wake of UBS now ask their clients as a routine matter whether they have foreign bank accounts?
Bill, I was just saying, at our firm, we've actually added it to our year-end tax package, where it's actually a question built right into it.
Right. And I don't know the answer. I mean, I think it's probably good to ask the question. But if you ask the question and you get the wrong answer, then you...
And I would add to that question. Remember, especially if you're working with clients who are moving here from overseas, the U.S. reporting system is very different than most other countries in the world. So the IRS especially, but also advisors, often assume too much that the clients know what they're supposed to do. So especially if you're working with someone who has moved from overseas, you want to start from the beginning as to the way the U.S. system works. And they may walk out the door after that, but you'll be safer.
I'd like to just comment on the question, should you have a specific question in your questionnaire that you send to clients, do you have foreign bank accounts? And I think the answer, another takeaway, is absolutely yes. I want to give you an example of something that's in our office right now. A client is subject to, I would guess, a better part of $1 million in penalties. And the family is very upset. They're upset with the CPA. And the CPA, they say the CPA should have known, the CPA should have filed, and the CPA didn't. And so the attorney for the family put together a demand letter against the CPA, the beginning of the malpractice action, and said, Morris, we would like you to comment on it before we send it out. And so we are in the process right now of analyzing it. But whenever you do an analysis, at least in our office, we like to think through what the possible answers might be so that we don't just start doing research, but we have a hypothesis, we either prove it or disprove it. And the first thing that I did is I asked myself, did the CPA know or have a reason to know about these foreign bank accounts? And the conclusion that I came to is that the CPA probably did not have either know or have a reason to know. And under those circumstances, the CPA was not violating his duty to his client by failing to report. The thing, of course, got a little bit complicated in our particular case because there were other bank accounts which the CPA knew about, should have reported, and didn't report. But I believe that the CPA did report these bank accounts for income tax purposes so that there would be no FBAR penalty for the accounts that the CPA reported, at least for income tax purposes. The bottom line is, don't rely on the kindness of strangers, in this case me, or somebody like me, because the knee-jerk reaction would be to simply say, sure, go ahead, file a demand letter, let the chips fall. And it was only because I've been there before. I happen to be a CPA myself, though I've practiced as a lawyer for the last 25 years. But I wanted to make the extra effort, and I'm sure that I did the right thing, because at the end of the day, in a malpractice situation, a lot of effort is expended. And if it turns out that the CPA is not liable after all, might as well know about it to begin with. But the point is, you don't want to go there. You don't want to have to go through the whole process. And so, if you have something in your questionnaire, do you have foreign bank accounts? And either the client does not complete the questionnaire, or the client completes it and checks off no. It protects you. In this particular case, though, if the client would have checked yes, and the client would have said yes, I have Canadian foreign bank accounts, the client probably would not have said, but I also have Swiss foreign bank accounts. So I'm not saying that the questionnaire is going to get you there, but it's certainly a lot better than that at all.
Well, that's what we do is if something we like international letter clients, if they don't answer the questionnaire, we have something in the cover letter that says, if you're not filling in your questionnaire, please at least answer the questions. And then if we have any reason to perceive that they have any international connections, in other words, somebody's foreign-born, somebody's a resident alien, we will actually go back and affirmatively ask them before completing the return. Because a lot of times people these days just don't use these organizers that are sent out for them to be in. So if Jonathan's alluding to, if we have any reason to believe there's any international connections, we go back after the fact and affirmatively ask them.
Well, let me ask this question. If the client says, yes, I have a foreign bank account in Canada, would you ask, and do you have any other foreign bank accounts? Or would you simply take that as at face value?
I think we would try to frame the question. I think we might come back and ask a follow-up question.
Yeah, and just a couple suggestions on that. In addition to asking just specifically about foreign bank accounts, questions like, what citizenships do you have? All of them. Several of the financial institutions in the U.S. ask this already. Have you ever lived in other countries? Do you have retirement accounts in other countries? So I would go even a little bit further than just the standard box of, do you have financial accounts? Part of the due diligence of knowing your client is really getting a big picture. So this whole foreign area, if there's any indication, you need to ask several questions, not just one question checking a box. You really want to go further than that. And you can see, because of the penalties and everything, your position is really in protecting your clients, and you're doing them a great service if you can try and get that information and get it reported properly.
One other side note, keep in mind as we get into the filing season, that June 30 deadline, this is one of the only forms I know of. It's a received date, not a postmark date.
That's
and
right.
Some people know that and some don't. But don't rely on right up to the final hour to get that out. They have to receive it by June 30.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's no extension for that one as well. In the back? Do you want to find out?
Send a nice letter with the form.
Yeah.
Why you did it.
Yeah,
exactly. You can't get the client signature in time. They have instructions to fax it before, and then right. Find you out, and the client's out of the country or something like that. And then you'll follow up with the signs from the way they
On behalf of M. Robinson & Company, I want to thank you all for coming and for your eager participation. Please help yourself to some extra refreshments. We have another half hour before we have to be out of the room. I wish to remind you, please, to fill out the evaluation forms on both sides. And you will next week receive our email invitation for our event 6 weeks from today, which I mentioned earlier, on offers in compromise and installment agreements, featuring attorney Jay Darby from Greenberg Traurig, the largest law firm in the world, Norman LeBlanc from Conlett & Renza CPAs, Michael Matuzik from the Appeals Department of the Internal Revenue Service in East Hartford, Connecticut, and Chili Rios from Internal Revenue Service in Boston. Same room, same schedule, on Tuesday, January 25th, 7:30 a.m. to 8:30 a.m., breakfast and networking, 8:30 a.m. to 12:30, program with 4 free credits of CPE for CPAs. Hope to see you then, and thank you again for coming.
Thank you, Debbie.